This podcast is brought to you by AJ Products, made in Sweden for the rest of the world. Visit ajproducts.ie to see how we can make your workplace work for you.
At least 13,000 children have died in Gaza in the last 6 months. That's more than in 4 years of global conflict. Now, thousands more are starving as famine sets in.
Tiny limbs, bones protruding. The constant sound of crying, these were little Yazan's final moments. His tiny fingers gripped in his mother's hand.
On Monday, the UN Security Council called for an immediate ceasefire and the release of Israeli hostages. But bombardments continue, debts mount, and survivors must hunt for food.
11-year-old Mohammed Zorab spends every day seeking food for his family.
UNICEF says Israeli authorities are placing arbitrary restrictions on convoys of food, preventing their delivery to starving people.
There are access points about 10 minutes from where those desperately hungry people are that could be used. Truth matters, life-saving aid matters, and both those things right now are being shelved.
This is In the News from the Irish Times. I'm Saoirse Pollock. Today, on the ground in Gaza, I speak with UNICEF spokesperson James Elder in Rafah.
The result of the voting is as follows. 14 votes in favour, 0 vote against, 1 abstention. The draft resolution has been adopted as resolution 2728.
James, can we start by just talking about a vote that happened earlier today? We're speaking on Monday when the UN Security Council passed a resolution calling for a ceasefire in Gaza. What is your immediate reaction to that news?
If it's implemented, Saoirse, that's the best news anyone could possibly hope for. Whenever I am talking to Palestinians, which is always, last week I was up in the north, today I was up in the north, it's incredible how many everyday people call out for a ceasefire, how mothers in a malnutrition ward will hold my hand and just say, please, ceasefire, ceasefire, and, you know, hoping that we have some special power, knowing, of course, that the power of their children lies somewhere else. So if it's implemented and the ceasefire means the bombardments stop and children can have a night when they go to bed and they know they're going to wake up next day, unlike the last so many months, then that's the best possible news we could hope for right now.
I want to talk to you some more in a moment, James, about the many children that you've met during your time there. But firstly, can we speak about the news that UNRWA, that the head of UNRWA, Philip Lazzarini, has said that Israel will no longer approve food convoys into the north of Gaza. Now, UNRWA has not been able to deliver food to the area since late January. And we're hearing repeated reports that famine will hit Gaza by May if there is no intervention. You are right there. How desperate is the food situation on the ground?
It's horrendous, enforced desperation, utterly man-made. I'm literally in the last hour just back from Jabalia, which is the far north. 30 or 40 kilometres to get to the far north. It took us 5 hours. And this is having taken days to get a clearance to get there. Did it military checkpoints for hours as you finally get into the north, and the north is where people are cut off. There's a checkpoint there that they cannot go south from. You have got thousands upon thousands of people on the streets just doing that universal hand-to-mouth signal of, I'm hungry, please. What's extraordinary, too, is that there's a gentleness there somewhere. There's a desperation, but we have our mission today was vaccines for children, nutritional supplies for malnourished children, and obstetrics for pregnant women. So in a loudspeaker, we will say we've only got these kind of supplies, and pass you do. But people are utterly desperate. They have not seen a food aid for days. You can see the hunger in people's faces. I've never seen anything like this in my 2 decades. I doubt many people have. the north is in a man-made imminent famine situation. And that is because, we have to be clear here, you know, it's because of those unnecessary restrictions, arbitrary denials. It's also because, Verica, there's one aid route we're allowed to use, and that's in the very south. So it's the very south. By the time it finally gets to Gaza, then we have to go on very, very busy roads because 1.5 million people are being crammed down here through all the checkpoints I spoke of and so on and so forth. There are old access points about 10 minutes from where those desperately hungry people are that could be used. So, you know, truth matters. Life-saving aid matters. And both those things right now are being shelved.
So effectively, there's lots of ways of getting food into the country, but it's just because of all these options being closed off that people are starving in the north.
Absolutely. Entirely man-made, entirely preventable. Now, if you want to be a real glass half full, because it's so man-made, it can be reversed. You know, you open up that access point I talk about in the north, and there's one right in Gaza City as well. You know, within a week, you turn around this severe malnutrition that's killing children.
James, as we've mentioned, you've been in Gaza twice in recent months. What is it like to physically walk the streets in different parts of the Gaza Strip? What does it smell like? What can you hear? What happens when you look around? What do you see?
I guess maybe I'd break it into three parts of Gaza, Serica, where I am now back in the south. Rafah, which is now five times what the population was. It's had its water systems, its sewage systems absolutely devastated. Its health systems, every system you imagine people rely on, have been devastated. So when you walk around here, you still get the smiles of people and the handshakes of children. You get this terrible smell of sewage. You get the stress on people's faces because, you know, they're in tents and they're on the sand and they've moved house three or four times and they're all have eyes of someone who's seen a loved one killed, or as they certainly, at the very least, all had to flee their home multiple times. So they're just hanging on by a thread. But as I say, you can get the warmth and you'll shake hands and so on. Next door, the neighbouring city, Serica, Khan Yunus is devastated. I mean, I've never seen annihilation like that. It's an entire city that's been flattened. I don't know how else to describe it. Street after street, everywhere you look is, you know, 2, 3, 4, 5-story buildings that are absolute rubble. And then, as I say, today, when you go to the north, much harder there to be on the streets because there is an absolute desperation. People want to tell you their story. The striking thing is, Erica, that anyone who speaks English wants to tell you what I know because of this work, but they're starving. They have no water. They're being bombarded every night. But they're desperate to tell me that because, of course, they assume the world doesn't know. Mm. How would this possibly be happening to them if the world knew? So, you know, so you listen. You can only listen. Or I listen to the young girl who today, a few hours ago, grabs my hand and asks for a tomato, a single tomato. Or a mother who explains her 12-year-old daughter has recurring dreams that she's eating a cucumber. This is what children dream of in the Gaza Strip, vegetables. But even those dreams we're unable to fulfill.
The sound of gunfire and explosions ring out around the Al-Shifa hospital. It finds itself once again under siege, surrounded by the Israeli...
What about access to medical aid? We keep hearing estimates of how many people who have been killed in this war, but tens of thousands must have been seriously injured. And you reported just last week that only 12 out of the 36 hospitals in Gaza are now partially functional. Where do people go when they're injured?
Well, it's a great question. Obviously, some go to hospitals. They're the ones I tend to see in hospitals. I go back this week, and it's the little boy and his little sister. But she, with, you know, now she's terribly shy and embarrassed because she got terrible burns, disfigure marks to her face from shrapnel. He's lost his eye. The family I met, the mother's had her leg amputated. The father's had two limbs amputated. Lying next to the mum is their critically injured son after their home was struck. So some people get to hospitals and they are wildly overcrowded. There are people with those wounds on the floor. many people don't. When I'm in the malnutrition ward in the north of Gaza, and I know full well that there are mothers with severely malnourished children or with wounds who can't get there. It's just not safe for them to try and get there. So there is another great concern, those with the wounds of war, but also those with children who desperately need nutritional support cannot get to help. And amid all this, Erica, it's the health staff who do 24-hour, 36-hour shifts. They just run, and then they go home and help their families search for food, search for water, prepare what they can.
James, your main focus in Gaza as the UNICEF spokesperson is communicating to the world the impact of this war on Palestinian children specifically, the serious risk of injury and death that they're facing, but also the long-term psychological impact. And just yesterday you posted on Instagram about the drones above Gaza, how they're like a child's soundtrack in Gaza and 50 thunderclaps rolled into one. Can you tell me a little bit about what the children are telling you? What does their body language tell you about the terror they've endured?
In the north particularly, because of the deprivation of food, and obviously because they've seen their parents have that moment when you know your mum and your dad can no longer protect you. So a lot of them are paper thin in a way as well, but they're frightened, they're fragile. You can see at times they will shake. They're much more skittish than they'd normally be. They're standoffish. You know, they are scared and hungry. And in here in the south, it can depend. You know, you'll still see children defy the odds and fly a kite and be just like children. As night falls, when I see children at dusk and so on, there's like a fear that comes over them. The bombardments are definitely more intense at night. Two, three days ago, talking to a group, several of the younger adolescents would say what their hope is. Their hope is to die. They want this to end. They want this over. There are many things, Erica, that I never thought I would see or hear. A child who's lost their entire family, mum, dad, brothers, sisters, aunts, uncles, grandparents. Not only do you see those and hear those things here, they're not even so unique numerically. They're relatively common. Sarah, I spoke to a colleague who I'd only just met a week or so ago. We were waiting at a checkpoint. I didn't know him, and I inquired about his family. And he explained to me that he'd come home late from work and his family had all gone to a dinner and three-story house. Everyone had been killed, mum and dad and aunts and uncles, brothers, sisters. And this was our conversation again, far from the first time I'd been told it.
Coming up, the Palestinians' special bond with Irish aid workers.
This podcast is brought to you by AJ Products, creating a more friction-free office. Made in Sweden for the rest of the world. Visit ajproducts.ie to see how we can make your workplace work for you.
There is so much international will, James, for this war to stop. We see it constantly here in Ireland through protests, an endless stream of social media posts calling for a ceasefire. But yet we all feel powerless. And watching your videos, I can hear the desperation in your voice.
Everywhere I travel, there is a special place for the Irish. It's quite extraordinary. Gaza is probably the only, but I'm Australian, so I've always been happy with that as well. But I must admit, Gaza's the only place I've ever thought about fibbing and saying I'm Irish, because I see some Irish colleagues who get even bigger hugs from people. You have a special bond here, so I'm totally unsurprised that it's resonating with people in Ireland. I'm not sure it is everywhere. I'm not sure the general public in all Western countries are aware in the same way. I've certainly seen polls that would be concerning. But yes, you're right. I've vacillated in this role from thinking we just might be turning the tide in shining a light on the restrictions on aid and what that's meaning and opening it up and maybe avoiding this catastrophe of a military offensive into Rafah. And then I have moments that I hope are not ones of clarity when I think this is all going to happen. All of this will be pursued, and we are going to somehow somehow the days ahead are much worse than these. And I think I totally understand why people tune out. It's a horrendous thing to watch regularly. I do still have a belief that the kind of pressure we're seeing, that people on social media, whether they're talking to a family member, whatever it is people are doing, you know, people, two of my kids are in Scotland showing me marches on the weekend, people marching. I think these things matter. And I critically think Palestinians are becoming aware that whilst some of those in power are not making the decisions to protect them, many of the people that they represent care and care deeply.
What would you say to the belief in many parts of the world that information coming out of Gaza cannot be trusted? I mean, both information coming from the IDF and information coming from Hamas, that it's unclear what's going on, that misinformation abounds in all of this. What is clear to you in this ongoing war?
You mean UNICEF? UN, we are very, evidence is everything for us. So when I'm doing this work, I'm led first and foremost by evidence, by my brain around my mandate. And then it's, you know, if you will, with my heart that propels it. But, you know, we speak, the backbone is evidence. And the evidence says that we just have endless records that are, you know, being broken of humanity's darkest moments. More children killed in Gaza in less than 6 months and 4 years of world conflict. I think it's 13,000 reported now. What I'd say to that when people say, yes, but that's the Hamas-controlled Ministry of Health, I would say, yes, but we're in past conflicts, when we've looked back and done our triangular verification, we've found that we've had no reason not to trust those numbers. And let's say it's not 13,000. Let's say it's 7,000 dead children. What's the number of children killed horrendously, rising every day, that makes the world stop? And, of course, we're not counting those under the rubble. But of those records broken, the highest number of people facing catastrophic hunger in two decades of keeping this data from the most respected independent nutritional survey in the planet. Record displacement, as anyone can see. Record number of airstrikes, as you will see from the major powers. Certainly worse devastation to homes and buildings than in living memory, two-thirds. And so they're all numbers that are backed and verified and so on and so on. And then, of course, I have the dubious advantage of being able to see those and bear witness to those.
You mentioned that dubious advantage of bearing witness. I know this is not about you, that you are there purely to report on what's going on, but I want to briefly ask about the logistics of getting in and out, crossing a border when Palestinians cannot, and any fear that you feel for your own personal safety, given that journalists, aid workers do not have protection in this war in a way that perhaps they might do in other conflicts?
Yeah, it's a great question, Serica. And I mean, you're right. It does feel indulgent to talk about, you know, my own thing when I can leave and when I realise that only returning now in the last week, and to think of what a 5-7-year-old is going through night after night after night. But no. And I've been in many conflict zones and I don't like them. And you have faith in the UN security systems and very good colleagues. But let's be honest, this war has killed more UN colleagues than any war in the history of the United Nations. There is nowhere safe. I've made that very clear from when I was first here in November, December. And again, there's clear evidence on why there is nowhere safe. And that means for aid workers as well. You know, I said to someone a couple of nights ago when there was a very intense bombardment at 3 a.m., trying to work out how far away things were from us and realizing it was hundreds of meters with bombardment that I'd not really heard before. And you lie in bed and it feels like you're lying in a coffin. It's just question of luck, planning, I don't know. So, no, there is no sense of safety. And then, of course, I think with those bombs as they hit and the building I'm in shudders, you think, again, what, 150 nights of this for a 10-year-old girl, you know, 100 metres from me in her building or in her tent? But no, nowhere is safe and nowhere will be safe until there is that ceasefire.
Finally, James, you are speaking to us from Gaza. When you look around you right now, what hope do you have? Is there hope that an end is in sight to this horrendous conflict?
I don't know. I'm torn on that, Serica. I have to always paraphrase the Palestinians who I speak with, and, you know, the mum who will tell me that she's lost loved ones, she's lost her home, she's lost her job, she's lost her ability to regularly feed her children, and will say, all I have is hope. But then that juxtaposes with the adolescent girl who tells me she hopes she dies. Certainly what mums who are holding children, as I saw in the severely malnourished children a week ago, who were, you know, anguishing over them and have done everything to keep them alive from bombs, and now their children were at threat of starvation. Certainly those people are aware that the ability to protect their child is no longer with them. Those decisions are being made elsewhere. And so we have to hope, and as you said earlier, you know, have to hope that people around the world will keep putting pressure so that decisions are made that justify that hope and that do protect these children.
James Elder, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast today.
It's a pleasure, Serica.
That's all for today. For more reporting from Gaza, subscribe at irishtimes.com/subscribe. I'm Serica Pollock. Today's episode was produced by Declan Conlon and Aideen Finnegan. In the News, we'll be back tomorrow.